the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about two blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
This year, we'll be live from the streets of Washington, D.C. That's the Homelessness Marathon Broadcast, coming to you soon and heard right here on this radio station.
This station is KBOO Portland. Hear the Homelessness Marathon live beginning at 5 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, and continuing until 6 a.m. Thursday morning.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and it is now just 11 o'clock. Next on the Boo, on the Food Show, Dr. Antonella Aguilera Ruiz describes her new podcast from Slow Food. Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising gives advice about preparing and designing the garden. And James Cohn talks about CiderCon and the growth of the cider industry in America. And I have a quick community announcement this morning. Students at the Metropolitan Learning Center have organized a climate conference, good for them. ClimateCon PDX will be held this Saturday, February 20th, at the Vestas Conference Center at 1417 Northwest Everett Street. It will run from 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. and will feature keynote addresses from Camilla Thorndike of OregonClimate.org, Mike Rosen of the Portland School Board, and Nick Caleb, local climate activist. And now stay tuned for The Food Show with host Chris Siegel. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect because you can't turn a fast dollar.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. On the show today, Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising will be returning to talk with me about how planning and designing a year-round garden. This year, we'll feature Marisha on The Food Show every month for specific information you can take and apply to your personal garden. I'll also have some food news that we are following here at The Food Show. At the end of the hour, I'll be talking with James Cohn from Wandering Angus Cider Works. He'll tell us about CiderCon, the recent gathering of cider makers here in Portland, as well as the state of the cider industry in the United States. But first, there is more food radio in Portland. In January, the first episode of the new podcast, Snail by Snail, was released. Snail by Snail is produced by Slow Food Portland and hosted by Antonella Aguilera Ruiz, and new episodes will be available monthly. The first episode features a conversation with Chef Ryan Mead from Bent Brick in Northwest Portland. We are joined by the host of Snail by Snail, Antonella Aguilera Ruiz, to talk about the podcast and Slow Food Portland. Antonella, welcome to The Food Show.
Thank you for having me.
So why did you create the podcast Snail by Snail?
So that idea came from, you know, it takes a lot of effort to put on events, and we really wanted to just start expanding the conversation of this opportunity that maybe people would go out to a restaurant, but they wouldn't necessarily talk with the chef or talk with different people. So we really wanted to just get the conversation going and almost be a fly on the wall of what are other people doing in the food world, and also the breadth of different ways to work in the food world, that it's not only chefs, it's not only farmers, that there's producers, that there's food activists, that there's a really wide variety of people working in the world of food.
Before you started the podcast, did you have any audio or journalism experience?
Absolutely none. So I'd listened to a lot of podcasts and I thought, well, I really like the setup of the interview, but I had absolutely no experience with audio or journalism. So it's been a huge learning curve too.
So what's that learning curve been like?
It's been good. There are frustrating moments of just the technological aspect of not knowing anything about sound. So I've had to learn a lot. Luckily, Margie Gibson, who's the wife of our Slow Food Chair, has been such a remarkable help to really help me figure out GarageBand and mics. But in the end, I've found that I've really enjoyed it. And the editing process, although long, has been really fun. So that's actually been a surprise. I thought the tech stuff was going to be an obstacle to get over, but it's become really enjoyable as well.
So you mentioned the idea of connecting people. And I want to know specifically, what do you want to accomplish with the podcast?
Well, the big question that we're trying to answer, something that's very central to Slow Food, is this idea of good, clean, fair. And those words are seemingly simple, but they're such a huge idea. And I think what someone thinks of good could be very different from someone else. But in that tension, there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of conversations that need to take place. So I think it's really just posing this question, what is good, clean, fair, and have, it's just something we can return to again and again. And I know Ryan mentions that in the first episode, that answer is always changing. So my hope is that it just has that seed that we're continuously thinking, like, what do these words mean and how do we apply them? And then ultimately, how do we live them?
And I imagine those words, they mean different things to different people. So what kinds of people can we expect on the podcast?
Yeah, so there's all sorts of people. Of course, Ryan, he was a chef. We'll have a chef coming up, actually comes out tomorrow. Then we'll also have producers. So we have Libby and Paul from the Oregon Olive Mill. I'll also be talking to Gita from the Portland Public School. So that'll be a very different perspective of childhood nutrition and school lunches, as well as the women from Adelante Mujeres, which is also a nonprofit with a food prescription program, as well as farmers and people involved with seed saving. So we'll get a lot of different perspectives about what those words mean.
And who is the target audience for the podcast?
I think we're trying to access a bit of a younger crowd, too. We have people who've been around for a long time who really understand slow food. But I think there's also a younger generation that perhaps it isn't at the top of their minds. They're busy and they're working. And we really just wanted to put this idea of maybe they're listening to the podcast and it helps them get to the grocery store and maybe think twice about the chicken they buy, or maybe will inspire them to go to the farmer's market or get in touch with someone who's doing really good, sustainable local food.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the first episode specifically. So you talked with Chef Ryan Mead from Bent Brick. What were some of the highlights from that first episode?
Chef Ryan has been just, I think we actually butt heads a little bit when we first met. I think we're both very passionate people. And I think what's really highlighted in the episode is I came to him and working with him thinking, oh, he's going to be this cocky chef and he really just thinks he knows everything. And that really could be anything further from the truth. He's someone who I think has had a transformation in seeing that food has this incredible potential for change in connecting community and connecting people to the farm, that there's this really sincere humbleness in his work that to me was really just such a learning experience and I think really plays through in the interview. And he's also, we catch him right before he moves to Michigan. So there's a significant move. So unfortunately, he's not in Portland, but he's taking all these ideas in this this real excitement back to a place that I think needs good, clean, fair food quite remarkably. He wants to make food accessible to people and affordable. And I think that's such a fresh perspective from a chef who comes from fine dining originally.
Yeah. What else did you find that was sort of surprising or interesting that changed your perspective?
Yeah, I think that idea that food needs to be accessible. So his dream is really to see a restaurant where people every day it can just be affordable, that it doesn't have to be that people are putting $50, $100 out on a tab, that it can be simple, that it can really also inspire people to go home and cook, that this isn't an exclusive experience to just the restaurant, that he's really about making this food as an inspiration for people to get their hands dirty and really do hands-on things like make pasta or make pasta sauce or maybe play with making their own sausages. But that it really, it's just about cooking at home too.
That's interesting. Yeah, it seems like a lot of the conversation with chefs today is that disconnect between actually reaching the people who are cooking food. And so it sounds like he recognizes that the importance of connecting with people, not just the people who can afford to come to his restaurant.
Absolutely. Yeah, that it's about, I think, setting an example, that it's not just coming and having this wonderful meal and then leaving like, oh, I don't think I could do that at home, but really empowering people to think, oh, hey, maybe if I take a class or I get a cookbook or he's going to give me this recipe, I can make this at home too, that it's not unattainable, that food doesn't need to be complicated. And if we're starting with good ingredients, it can really just be simple and easily prepared at home as well.
So you said that the second episode comes out tomorrow. Could you give us a little teaser of what we can expect?
Yeah, so we'll have our second chef. Her name's Chef Kusuma Rao. And she's just a wonderful, wonderful cook. I actually wish we could smell her food through the podcast, but unfortunately we can't. So she combines Indian cuisine and Sonoran cuisine. So she has this exquisite use of spices. And we really just delve into her creative process. So how she thinks through a dish, what she's trying to say through food. So I think that's this wonderful insight into the creative process. She also bakes incredible bread. So we'll really delve into what she loves about bread and why that's so important to her. But there's a lot of insight, I think, of how she thinks about food, which is really, really unique and really exciting.
What would you like to see this podcast do or become?
I think I'd really just like it to get people thinking and hopefully change some of their choices. In slow food, there's this idea that we're all eaters. So every time we eat or purchase food, the way we do that, how we engage and how we eat has the potential to create incredible change. So if the podcast does anything, I hope it just gets people thinking, maybe there's one area where I could do things a little bit differently, or maybe I should go to the farmer's market and talk to this farmer and ask him about what he's growing. Really just inspire people to think about things maybe in a different way or add another perspective.
So Snail by Snail is from Slow Food Portland. And so I want to talk a little bit more about slow food in general. Could you give us sort of the background? What is the slow food movement?
Yeah, so the slow food movement was started in Italy in the 80s when in Rome they were going to open a McDonald's. So on the Spanish Steps, this group got together to protest, and in protest they decided to eat bowls of pasta and to eat it slowly. So it was really this response to fast food, to agriculture, and the culture around food really being lost for that really high processed foods and production and quickness. So slow food really came out of that. And it's now has chapters all over the world, really guided by that vision of creating good, clean fare. But this aspect of slowness is also really important. Like, what's a slow life? Like, what aspects of our culture are so fast that we're losing something in that velocity, in that, you know, just that quick living?
So you say it's all over the world. Who gets involved with the slow food movement?
All different people. There's a big, especially in the United States, there's a big school garden program, producers, farmers, people just passionate about a sustainable food system. There's events, for example, Slow Meat, which is really around this conversation of how do we create sustainable meat. There will be Slow Fish in New Orleans coming up here in March about fish and seafood and sustainability. So it really draws a big variety of people, but I think what's really united is knowing that our food system affects so much. It affects the environment, it affects our health, it affects our communities, childhood nutrition through school gardens. So anybody who really sees that as important, there's all different ways to get involved.
What was it about the movement that brought you to Slow Food Portland?
I just love to eat, and I think when that love was really flourishing, I just remember the Italians and how well they do that, where you take time to eat, and really that meal time is just so central to the culture and the way you relate to people. And then slowly in my work, I'm also a naturopath, I've just seen what an important impact food has. And so it's not just, you know, getting the right fruits and vegetables, but that conversation is so much broader of how are we paying our farmers? What impact is this having in the environment? And I think because I have a health perspective, I see that so closely interrelated that I think slow food really encompasses all of that, but also has this aspect of conviviality and enjoyment and really just enjoying food and celebrating that and uniting that. So that was, I think, what brought me to slow food.
Have you seen or felt that being a part of slow food has sort of changed the way you approach your practice and the way you approach food?
It has, yes. I think I have this bent where it's really important for me to communicate to people, you know, where it's possible. Let's think about the production of your food. For example, olive oil, and we'll be talking about olive oil in March, is such a good example of really conveying what a different product olive oil is if you have a relationship or some knowledge about the food system that it's coming out of or the production, because there's such varying degrees of quality that if you're maybe getting a cheaper, not pure product, that's really going to affect your health as well. So that the transparency through the process, if we have a little bit of knowledge, can really impact our health. So personally, that's been, I've learned a lot in that process.
So besides Snail by Snail, what are some of the other projects that Slow Food Portland is working on?
So we've got a few very exciting projects. First, we have Slow Wine, which is a slow Pinot, which we have in different supermarkets all around the city and different vendors. And that's raising money to send delegates to Terra Madre in September, which is a huge slow food event in Italy, in food convention. We're also partnering with Portland Public Schools. So Portland Public Schools has this wonderful program where they have a harvest of the month, where they're featuring a local vegetable on their menu. But the challenge there is to actually get kids to eat it. So to get kids to eat kale or parsnips, for example. So the board is volunteering and really starting the seed program of how we can be hands on the ground to really encourage kids to try kale. I know volunteers were there last Thursday handing out sampling cups, because the more exposure kids get to these new vegetables, the more likely they'll be able to try them. So that's something that we're very, very excited about working on.
And how can people get involved with Slow Food Portland?
So all sorts of different ways. I think the primary way is to check out the website, which is slowfoodportland.com. There's a volunteer with us link, and you can get in touch. We're currently looking for people to help with social media. We're going to need volunteers for the Portland Public School program. And as we develop more and more programs, we always need hands to either help with setup, even just brainstorming. So going through the website is the best way to get involved. You can also see our events there. We'll have a potluck coming up at the end of February on, I believe it's Sunday the 28th, if that's the Sunday. And that's free for everybody to come and bring a dish and share and really learn more about slow food and reconnect and see what we've been doing and what we'll be up to this year.
And if people want to hear the podcast, Snail by Snail, how do they go about doing that?
Yes, they can also go to our website. It pops up on the blog, and they can also get on our newsletter list because it's emailed to all our subscribers as well.
Great. Antonella, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Antonella Aguilera Ruiz talking about the new podcast, Snail by Snail, from Slow Food Portland. To find more information about the podcast, you can visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website. In a moment, I'll be talking with Marisha Auerbach about garden planning and design. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio.
Pachamama, Almighty Jah. Advise the sun, advise the moon, create the flow to get things done, yeah. Grab the tools, time to get smarter. Grab the drum, try to make harder.
Original thing.
Don't walk, grandmama.
Turn Janica
one. We don't wanna.
Original thing.
Don't walk, grandmama.
Turn Janica
one. We don't wanna. Water drop, body drop the water. Just drop the water so water can drop. Water drop, body drop the water. Just drop the water so water can drop. Water drop, body drop the water. Just drop the water so water can drop. Water drop, body drop the water. Just drop the water so water can drop. No work, no belly, no food, no funny.
That was the song Slow Food by Terracotta. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. We're going to have a regular segment on The Food Show featuring Marisha Auerbach from Permaculture Rising. She'll be talking with us each month about tips and strategies to growing a year-round garden. We are currently in the season of planning, and so the topic of conversation today is designing and mapping the garden. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
And listening to that music, I think that we need an intro song, so maybe we'll have to work on that this month.
All right, I got a few suggestions.
Perfect. So let's start with, at the very beginning, what is the first step when thinking about planting a garden?
Well, I think the first step is thinking about what you like to eat. And in planting a garden, when you think about what you like to eat, you could also consider what are the things that are most expensive at the store that you adore eating in your diet that are hard to afford. Some foods are highly perishable that we can grow. I think with planning a garden and figuring out where you're going to put it in your landscape, it's important to think about our primary limiting factors in this climate. Our two main limiting factors to production in this climate are heat, because we have really cool evenings in the summer, and water, because we have those extremely dry summers. So through microclimate development and identifying how you can maximize your heat and water over time, we can really develop some really resilient gardens.
Now, we're talking about mapping a garden. Are you suggesting that we actually create a map?
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile to create a map of your garden. Right now in February, there's areas that are warming up faster than others based on the angle of the sun. And so people who plant their peas in those warmer areas this month are going to have an earlier harvest, which is cherished because the peas are the first things to eat. So I recommend going to either Portland Maps or the Metro Mapping Tool if you live in the city, or if you're outside of Portland, you can go to Google Maps and create a base map. For my students, I actually posted on my blog how to make a base map, and that can be found at marishab.wordpress.com.
Awesome. And so what sort of planning steps can we take to have the most variety in the garden?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, making a list of what you like to eat is a good step. As you think about what you like to eat, then it's important to think about what time of year those fruits and vegetables become available. And a really good way to identify that is to shop at the local farmers market and to see what's available. Here in Portland, we're fortunate to have a number of year-round farmers markets, so we can see what's available in the thin times of the year and know that we really have quite a bit of diversity that can be coming fresh out of the garden in February. So you can also look at seed catalogs and sourcing a lot of local seed catalogs from the Willamette Valley that have signed the Safe Seed Pledge and pledged to not grow genetically modified seeds. So we have a lot of wonderful seed companies in the Willamette Valley that do not offer genetically modified seeds, and they have a tremendous amount of diversity of crops that do very well in this climate. And I think that's really important, is to make sure that the seeds that you're planting are ones that are developed for this climate so they can thrive with those limiting factors that I mentioned earlier of our cool evenings and not as hot summers and dry summers.
So when we're talking about creating the map, what are some tips? What should we keep in mind when we're trying to put things in certain places?
Well, the first layer I make is a base map that just shows all the things on the site that aren't going to change. So if you have a raised bed in your yard and you might change it, I wouldn't include it on the base map. And I tend to do my base maps in black and white. I always orient them with north facing up so that it's really easy to identify the warmest areas as the sun's going to be coming from the south. We have cooler sunshine that comes from the southeast, and the sunshine that comes from the southwest is really hot. So those are some microclimates that are important to develop that can be identified by looking at what we call a sun sector. And that's how the sun moves through the sky and how it differs from the winter solstice to the summer solstice.
So we're not quite at the optimal growing time yet. What peripheral jobs can people work on now to get ready for their garden?
Well, making a map is a great way to start. Then you can identify where you want to grow what you've got. And as you make that list of the plants that you like to eat, then you can get ready to start seeds by ordering the seeds from the companies you want to buy them from, or by getting them from a local seed library or somewhere where we can get local seeds here in Portland. You could get your soil tested so you know what the constituents are in your soil and how you can amend it. After you get your soil tested, then you can also develop your compost pile so that you have fertility ready for your soil. Compost helps with the water storage capacity in the summer, and it also helps with the nutrient holding capacity as well as preventing erosion. There's so many good things that the compost does. And so having compost available for your plants will ensure a good harvest. If you don't have composting on site, maybe you are in an apartment or you're going to plant in containers, having a good source to get your organic matter is important, and making sure that that's a clean source. I recommend that people aren't afraid to ask questions of the people that they're getting their organic matter from so that you know that it hasn't been contaminated with chemicals. And also, this month you can plant peas in the ground, so we can get started with the first crop of the year.
I want to go back to the soil testing, because it can be sort of a complicated process. You get the results, and you have to figure out how to read them. What your soil actually consists of. What are some of your recommendations for getting your soil tested and reading the results?
I usually go through A&L Labs. They're in Tigard, I believe. And you can just take 6 inches of soil and put it in a yogurt container and drop it off there, or you can mail it to them. That's A&L Labs West. And when you get their report of what's in your soil, concentrates down in Milwaukee will help you read it. And concentrates is our best local supplier of organic fertilizers. So after they help you read it, then they'll set you up with exactly what you need to be able to amend your soil appropriately.
And I know it's also important because a lot of spaces in Portland have been used for different things throughout its history to learn the toxicity, if there's anything that shouldn't be in your soil.
Yeah, and if you think that there's something that shouldn't be in your soil, then you'll need to do a more advanced soils test. I think it was $30 extra to have my soil tested for lead. When I got my soil tested last through A&L, their basic soil test is $13. And with a basic soil test, you can also say what crop you want to grow in that soil, and they'll give you specific recommendations, or you can say you want just general recommendations for a vegetable garden.
So I want to talk about what's coming up. We'll have you back on in March, but what are some things that people can think about doing for March?
Well, to get ready for March, right now is a great time to prune trees. We talked about pruning trees last Wednesday. I was on KBOO also with the dirt bag, and we talked about pruning grapes. I've been pruning my berry bushes. It's a good time for transplanting bare root trees or bare root berry bushes. And I consider those things the bones of the garden. So as I make my map, I consider those permanent elements once they go in. And I think about those microclimates and how I can even develop other microclimates with trees and berries. So on Tuesday, March 15th is when I'm going to be doing my next my next workshop, which is going to be on indoor seed starting, early plantings, and perennial crops. Some of those perennial crops are starting to come up now. I had garlic chives in my breakfast this morning, and I've been harvesting my burdock root, making some kimchi and some bitters. Nettles are out there for harvesting right now. And there's also chives coming up, other perennial crops. And if you're going to be starting seeds indoors, now's a really good time to prepare that space so that you're ready.
Great. Well, Marisha, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us about the home garden.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Marisha Auerbach talking about planning and designing your home garden. To learn more about her series of classes, you can visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website. You're listening to The Food Show. I'm Chris Siegel. In a moment, I'll be talking with James Cohn at Wandering Angus Cider Works. But first, here are a couple of news stories we are following at The Food Show. In a recent article published in Nature Plants, John Reginald, professor of soil science and agroecology at Washington State University, and his collaborators determined that organic farming is more adaptable to the conditions created by climate change than conventional farming. Reginald analyzed data from the past 40 years with a focus on the impacts of organic agriculture on the future of sustainability. Reginald describes the article by saying, "If I had to put it in one sentence, organic agriculture has been able to provide jobs, be profitable, benefit the soil and the environment, and support social interactions between farmers and consumers." Reginald adds, "In some ways, there are practices in organic agriculture that really are ideal blueprints for us to look at feeding the world in the future." Reginald found that by focusing on soil health, organic farms can actually have higher yields than conventional farms during drought years. Whereas conventional farms use synthetic fertilizers to give nutrients to the soil, organic farms focus on overall soil health through a number of methods such as mulching, composting, and crop rotation, which allows the soil to hold water and nutrients better than conventional soil. Also, earlier this month, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was signed into agreement. It now goes to national legislatures in order to be ratified by individual nations, including the United States. The climate director of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, Ben Lilliston, says the TPP supports an extractive, climate-damaging mode of globalization that has led to mass deforestation, fossil fuel withdrawal, and an energy-intensive industrial model of agriculture. The TPP, as it stands, benefits large corporations who want to expand their market power and lower regulations. There are currently provisions that would ban certain types of seed saving and that expand market access for agricultural biotechnology, giving greater control of the food system to multinational corporations. There is also the fear that it would impact food security by relaxing regulations on foods imported into the United States. The TPP would increase current problems facing sustainable agriculture and make it harder for small-scale farms to grow and thrive. To find more information about the news stories we are following here at The Food Show, you can visit The Food Show page on the KBOO website. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. In January, the event CiderCon was hosted here in Portland. CiderCon is put on annually by the United States Association of Cider Makers, and it brings together cider makers from all over the country to talk about all things cider. Joining us on The Food Show, we have James Cohn, from Wandering Angus Cider Works, who attended the conference. Wandering Angus is located in Salem, Oregon, and specializes in cider varieties that originate from France, England, and pre-Prohibition America, with apples that are grown in Oregon. James, welcome to The Food Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's begin with your story. Why did you start making cider?
I actually just fell into it. I learned about cider in New Hampshire, where I used to live, and down the street from me was a apple orchard called Poverty Lane Orchards, and they actually make a cider called Farnham Hill Cider, and they served it at our farmer's market there in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and I really found a drink that I could really enjoy. At that time, drank a little bit of beer, not wine, but I found something that really resonated with me. After that, moved to Salem, Oregon, a neighbor here, Nick Gunn, who now co-owns Wondering Angus with me, he and his wife, Mimi Castilla, just started a cidery. So I joined up forces with them, and that was in 2005.
So there are a lot of different types of ciders on the market. What kind of cider do you prefer making?
Our ciders, we have two different brands at Wondering Angus Cider Works. We have Wandering Angus cider that's made from heirloom cider apples, and that's what we started with. We also make a cider called Anthem, and that cider is made from regular culinary apples like you would find in any supermarket, so Granny Smith, Braeburn, Fuji, Honeycrisp. Even though there's different apples that we're using, we apply the same philosophy, and that is it's just apples pressed and fermented. With Anthem, we add different fruits and hops, but with Wondering Angus, it's just apples. Sometimes we use pears, called peri pears. But that basically is our philosophy, is just to use ciders or make ciders from apples that are pressed and fermented.
So do you have any specific apples that you prefer to grow or select for cider?
We have, in Oregon, there's about 80 acres that grows for Wondering Angus, and they're all grown organically, and the varieties that we grow, about 15 different varieties. Out of those, our preferred are our single varietal ciders that we make. Golden Russet, which is an apple from about the 1830s, is really a wonderful apple that has great sugar levels, so we can ferment out really well, and it has this great dry honey flavor. And also Wixen, which is a crab apple that was actually developed in Northern California during the 1930s.
So I want to know maybe the difference between the different kind of apples. People think about a crab apple and they think, you know, at least I do. I had a crab apple tree growing up. It was very sour. It was bitter. I enjoyed it anyways because it was there and fun. But what are the differences between the different apples that are used for making cider?
Yeah, so in the cider world, you basically divide up the apples into their tannin levels. So they have high tannin or low tannin, and then their acid level. So high acid, low acid. So if you put that on a grid, you basically have four quadrants. So you have low tannin, high acid, low tannin, low acid, low tannin, high acid, low tannin, low acid. And those different apples have different names. So the low tannin, low acid would be called sweets. Low tannin, high acid are called sharps. And sweets and sharps are what make up most of the culinary apples. So a sweet would be, an example would be Red Delicious is a sweet. There's not a lot of acidity going on there. And there's not a lot of high tannins. There are actually some tannins that you get, but it's mostly sweet. A sharp apple, a great example would be Granny Smith, that it's really, really tart. Golden Russet and Wixen fall within that sharp category, but they're on the extreme high, especially the crab apple. Wixen is on that extreme high side with acidity. Then with the tannin levels, we call those bitter sweets if they have low acid, and bitter sharps if they have high acid. Tannins, just like in wine, add a point of interest and complexity to the profile. So we use those at Wondering Angus in select ciders. So we have a cider called Oak Dry that we've been making since about 2006 that uses the bitter sweet apples, and we blend those with sharp apples so we can add some acidity. Those are the general categories. But then within those specific categories, such as in sharp, you're going to have different apples that accent aromatics or have different flavors that cider makers choose so that they're able to develop their ciders from those core apples.
And you've told us you're working with a number of varieties. I feel like as consumers of apples, we're eating primarily the sweets that you were talking about. And you know, even in that category, it kind of gets whittled down to a few that most people eat. How many apples total or varieties are we talking about that you use for cider making?
We use about, between the two brands, I would say we use in the ballpark of 25 to 30 different varieties. cider making traditionally is about blending. So you're blending different cider apple varieties or different apple varieties together, and then you're fermenting them. Once you have things fermented, you're blending, and then even blending back juice after things are fermented. So it's a lot of blending going on. And with that, to apples, any apple will ferment. Any apple you can make cider out of, but different apples have different profiles. And you can get that if you eat a Granny Smith or you eat a Braeburn, and they taste different, and they ferment different too. So part of the skill with cider making, at least your traditional cider making, is that it's how you blend those different profiles to make something that's interesting and people want to drink.
So we're going to be talking about CiderCon in a minute, but I want to get sort of a little bit more of your backstory. You said in 2005 is when Wandering Angus began. What was it like when you first started selling your cider?
It was an interesting environment. At that time, ciders were known, but because of a lack of diversity, the brands that were at were mainly ciders that came in six packs, and they competed more in the beer market, and that was the known quantity. And I have a saying that Woodchuck was the leading cider at that time. They had about 70% of the market, and people either loved Woodchuck or they hated cider. So they identified a lot of cider with a brand, but when we got out there, we New Seasons was one of our great first stores that picked us up, and also Life Source, which is a great store in Salem. But we were one of the only ciders on the shelf, so there wasn't much of a category that we were developing in those stores. And not until we started having other brands on the shelf and getting a category set did the sales of everyone start going. Because if you just have one cider on the shelf, it doesn't speak to the diversity that's there. And then someone will either like that cider or they won't. But if they don't have diversity there to support it, they're not going to explore that category. And in the Northwest, if you look at the beer sets, a lot of people want to explore. They want to try different flavors. They want to try different producers, different styles. And with cider in the beginning, most of the stores only offered one. And when they started offering more, we really started seeing acceleration, not only in our sales, but in the category in general.
I also imagine at that time, it was early in the gluten-free marketing, and that was probably a boost as well.
Yeah, gluten-free definitely helped. What we found, and we did some research on this, is that as a market, the folks seeking out gluten-free alternatives weren't substantial for our growth, but what they were really substantial for is that they demanded gluten-free alternatives. And especially with bars and restaurants, they demanded that there has to be something that wasn't, especially if they went to a beer bar or a brewery, that there's something that they could drink and enjoy that was high quality. And they demanded it. We were one of the options on the market. We came in, and what happened, though, is that the gluten-free people consumed the cider, but who really consumed it were the craft beer drinkers. And what happened was that cider became a legitimate part of the craft beer style list. So you would have an IPA, a porter, a stout, and a cider. And then once you had that, then again, diversifying out on different producers and different styles within cider. Right now, I would say in Portland, at least, and in Oregon in general, in the Northwest too, if a bar doesn't have a cider, at least, they're really far behind the times. And I think a lot of folks that are celiacs or have different gluten-free or gluten intolerances really help to get cider on the map. And then they helped to introduce it, kind of a symbiotic relationship with the craft beer culture.
So it sounds like your growth as a business was kind of tied to this sort of trend, this sort of national trend, and I guess regional in Portland as well. Just so describe, how has the business grown and changed for you over the years?
It's grown pretty substantially for introducing the brand Anthem. What we found early on, that Wandering Angus, which runs a lot like a wine model. So we grow apples, and we have people grow apples for us. We press the apples in the fall, and we have a large amount of juice, and then we have to ferment it and figure out what to do with it and then sell it. And that's a lot like a wine model. We introduced Anthem to try to be more like a brewery model, but still respecting our traditional cider roots. And by that, we're able to use the cold storage facilities that are throughout Oregon and Washington mainly to press apples year-round. And then we don't have to have a large glut of juice in the fall, but we can spread that out throughout the year. And that's principally how a brewery works. A brewery doesn't have all of its water, all its grain, all its hops at one time sitting at the brewery ready to go. They parse that out throughout the year so that they don't have a large cost structure that they have to deal with. And by using the readily available apples that are much more affordable than the organic heirloom apples for Wandering Angus, we're able to get the price points down that we can be competitive with the same pricing as craft beer.
So I want to get into that. I mentioned the CiderCon earlier, mm-hmm. and so there's this event that happened recently in Portland where cider makers from all across the country came together to have conversations and talk about sort of what you were dealing with as you were growing as a business. So what is the purpose of CiderCon?
So the purpose of CiderCon originally was twofold, and CiderCon originated in Oregon, and Salem actually was the first CiderCon in 2011. And the reason that we formed it was because at that time we ran into an issue with federal regulations around cider. With cider, if you make cider that's over 7%, it needs to get what's called a COLA, which is a Certificate of Label Approval, from the TTB, which used to be called the ATF. So that's only for ciders over 7%. If it's under 7%, it's FDA jurisdiction, so you don't require a COLA. When you get a COLA, you need to make sure that it's in wine standards of fill. So if cider's over 7%, it has to be in a 750 milliliter bottle or a 500 milliliter bottle or 750 or different increments of liters. If it's under 7%, it can be in whatever bottle you can put it in. So we got a value-added producer grant from the USDA to convert our apples into cider. And with that grant, we decided that we were going to expand our market and take our ciders, which that time were in 750 milliliter bottles, and put them in 22-ounce bottles. So we did that. And when we made our cider, which takes a couple months, and we filled our bottles. We usually test the bottles after we bottle. And when they got tested, they were 7.02% alcohol by volume. So we knew that we needed to get a label approval. So we applied for a label approval, but the 22-ounce bottle is not appropriate. So the people checking the labels in Washington at the TTB said, well, you have to dump out your cider. And we said, well, we're not going to dump our cider. We used a USDA grant to pay for this, and we're not going to dump it out. So that ended up resolving in an audit that we got, and it resolved that we had to end up paying a higher tax, and we weren't allowed to sell the cider. We could only sell it in Oregon, which wasn't that big of a deal, but we also had to pay a tax because the carbonation was over what's allowable for cider. So if cider is more than basically 15 PSI, which is what's called petulant. You get maybe three or four bubbles in the cider. If it's over that amount, it gets taxed as a champagne. So the tax essentially goes from 22.6 cents a gallon to, for us, it was $2.30 a gallon.
So
pretty big increase.
I want to know, so you said it kind of happened out of circumstance. Were other cideries facing the same problems around the country?
Yeah, so what happened is we brought this issue after we worked through the issue and paid a really high tax on cider, which was not economically feasible by any stretch for us, but we did it. We went to an event in Massachusetts organized by a gentleman named Ben Watson, who actually wrote a book called Cider Sweet and Dry, I believe the name of it is. But he put together an event in Massachusetts called Cider Days, and that at that time was the only event nationally where cider makers would get together and meet. So there's a round table there, and we brought up the issue, and we're saying, oh, we need to address this issue. And a woman from Virginia, a cider maker there named Diane Flint, kind of challenged me, well, why don't you get more cider makers together and organize kind of a conference? And that was in November of 2010, and then the first conference was in February 2011, and we had 45 people show up. And the significant thing about the 45 people is that they had had similar issues with especially the carbonation tax as a looming threat over them, because you can't really dial in the carbonation perfectly, especially when you're a small producer like us. At that event, Woodchuck came, who, again, was 70% of the market, and a lot of the leading cider makers came. So out of that 45 was a really strong group of cider makers, and we came up with some of the rudiments of what became the Cider Act, which actually just passed Congress in December. And Blumenauer, Representative Blumenauer, was one of the champions of that, as was Senator Wyden.
So how many people came this year to CiderCon?
So this year we had approximately, it's a rough estimate, but about 1,200 people attended.
So that's quite a substantial growth.
Yeah, an amazing growth.
So what were some of the highlights from this year's CiderCon?
Highlights this year were we brought over a delegation from the UK. Cider making has a lot of its roots in southern England, in Devon and Herefordshire, England. And the so we brought over a lot of the leading cider makers there to talk about their craft and what they're doing. That was a huge highlight and was really well received, especially all the comedy that they were broadcasting out. We also did a welcome reception at OMSI, where all the attendees came and some trade people from Portland area came to. Blumenauer, Congressman Blumenauer, spoke at our Friday lunch. And we also had representatives from U.S. Apple, which is the trade organization for the apple industry, come.
So the event is held all over, and it seems like it's been held in Chicago for a few years. What was special about it being held in Portland this year?
Well, this was the first time that it moved from Chicago. The conference is led by a committee, and that committee sends out a survey, and the survey every year said Chicago, Chicago, Chicago. But one of the large complaints about Chicago in February is that it's Chicago in February. So we decided as a committee to rotate the conference. So every other year it'll be in Chicago, and then on those alternate years, the focus will be more local with tours. And Portland was that coming back to our original roots where it started, and also being able to do some tours around Portland, which happened on Tuesday. But next year it goes back to Chicago, and then the year after that it'll go to another area, probably in the southern United States.
So what was the feeling when people left CiderCon this year? How were the cider makers feeling?
I mean, everyone was ecstatic. They loved Portland. We actually just got all the survey results back. And people just love the food scene in Portland. They love the drinks, the diversity, the number of bars, the number of ciders. There's a number of cider bars in Portland now, which is really unique. Portland essentially is the epicenter of cider, especially for the diversity available. And it's the second largest market per capita for cider. So the first is Seattle, and second is Portland. So it's a massive market, but we have more diversity than Seattle does for the amounts of ciders that we have. And being able to people that are mostly isolated in a lot of areas in the country. The large cider-making areas are the Northwest, Michigan, and around that apple-growing region, New York, New England, Virginia, and then there's a burgeoning industry now in California. And a lot of these are around apple-growing agriculture. So, and a lot of the producers are very small. So the membership of the United States Association of Cider Makers is really swayed to makers that are under 10,000 gallons a year, which is on that smaller side. And as you start getting larger, the numbers dwindle drastically.
So we have about 30 seconds left, and I'm going to ask you a really big question for the last 30 seconds. Sure. What is the future of cider in the United States?
The future of cider in the United States is that it's here to stay, and you're going to start seeing it become more legitimate and more selection as it starts to diversify. And don't be surprised if you see on signs where you used to just see wine, beer, that it'll be wine, beer, and cider.
James, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. And have some cider tonight.
That was James Kahn from Wandering Angus Cider Works talking about CiderCon and the state of cider in the United States. That's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Antonella Aguilera Ruiz, Marisha Auerbach, and James Kahn for being on today's show. I want to add a note from Marisha. She's going to be teaching a permaculture design course at White Oak Farm in Williams, Oregon. It's March 18th through April 11th, and you can find information at Permaculture Rising. Stay with us for this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. I also want to thank our excellent board operator, Patsy. And don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of March for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Way, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. A need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the tops on. And those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. Cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, February 17, 2016. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Jim Wallace, author of America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to New America, and a periodic spiritual advisor to President Obama, will be in Portland early next week as part of his book tour. He's turned the tour into a series of town hall meetings by inviting faith leaders in each city to join him for a public conversation about racism.
Because a large number of children in Portland were not vaccinated as required before returning to school, a Multnomah County vaccination clinic was available Tuesday to provide shots for students who are underinsured or uninsured and needing to be brought up to date on their immunizations.
In national news, as the presidential race moves into North Carolina, the battle is increasingly heated given the state's reputation for ugly political contests. Clinton and Sanders are putting their struggle into high gear to win the decisive black vote, given the large number of black voters in the South. Trump continues questioning whether Cruz is a legal citizen, as Republican contenders hope to leave North Carolina with a clear mandate for the state contest to follow.
Republican legislators in Florida must see themselves